A cloudy day, do you know what that is in a town of ironworks? The sky sank down before dawn, muddy, flat, immovable. The air is thick, clammy with the breath of crowded human beings. It stifles me. I open the window, and, looking out, can scarcely see through the rain the grocer's shop opposite, where a crowd of drunken Irishmen are puffing Lynchburg tobacco in their pipes. I can detect the scent through all the foul smells ranging loose in the air. The idiosyncrasy of this town is smoke. It rolls sullenly in slow folds from the great chimneys of the iron foundries, and settles down in black, slimy pools on the muddy streets. Smoke on the wharves, smoke on the dingy boats, on the yellow river, clinging in a coating of greasy soot to the house front, the two faded poplars, the faces of the passers-by. The long train of mules, dragging masses of pig iron through the narrow street, have a foul vapor hanging to their reeking sides. Here, inside, is a little broken figure of an angel pointing upward from the mantelshelf, but even its wings are covered with smoke, clotted and black. Smoke everywhere. A dirty canary chirps desolately in a cage beside me. Its stream of green fields and sunshine is a very old dream, almost worn out, I think. From the back window I can see a narrow brickyard sloping down to the riverside, strewed with rain butts and tubs. The river, dull and tawny-colored, La Belle Riviere, drags itself sluggishly along, tired of the heavy weight of boats and coal barges. What wonder! When I was a child, I used to fancy a look of weary, dumb appeal upon the face of the negro-like river slavishly bearing its burden day after day. Something of the same idle notion comes to me today, when from the street window I look on the slow stream of human life creeping past, night and morning, to the great mills. Masses of men, with dull, besotted faces bent to the ground, sharpened here and there by pain or cunning, skin and muscle and flesh begrimed with smoke and ashes, stooping all night over boiling cauldrons of metal, laired by day in dens of drunkenness and infamy, breathing from infancy to death an air saturated with fog and grease and soot, vileness for soul and body. What do you make of a case like that, amateur psychologist? You call it an altogether serious thing to be alive. To these men it is a drunken jest, a joke, horrible to angels perhaps, to them commonplace enough. My fancy about the river was an idle one, it is no type of such a life. What if it be stagnant and slimy here? It knows that beyond there waits for it odorous sunlight, quaint old gardens, dusky with soft, green foliage of apple trees, and flushing crimson with roses, air, and fields, and mountains. The future of the Welsh puddler passing just now is not so pleasant. To be stowed away, after his grimy work is done, in a hole in the muddy graveyard, and after that, not air, nor green fields, nor curious roses. Can you see how foggy the day is? As I stand here, idly tapping the windowpane, and looking out through the rain at the dirty backyard and the coal boats below, fragments of an old story float up before me, a story of this house into which I happen to come today. You may think it a tiresome story enough, as foggy as the day, sharpened by no sudden flashes of pain or pleasure. I know, only the outline of a dull life, that long since, with thousands of dull lives like its own, was vainly lived and lost, thousands of them, massed, vile, slimy lives, like those of the torpid lizards in yonder stagnant water butt. Lost? There is a curious point for you to settle, my friend, who study psychology in a lazy, dilettante way. Stop a moment. I am going to be honest. This is what I want you to do. I want you to hide your disgust, take no heed to your clean clothes, and come right down with me, here, into the thickest of the fog and mud and foul effluvia. I want you to hear this story. There is a secret down here, in this nightmare fog, that has lain dumb for centuries. I want to make it a real thing to you. You, egoist, or pantheist, or Arminian, busy in making straight paths for your feet on the hills, do not see it clearly, this terrible question which men here have gone mad and died trying to answer. I dare not put this secret into words. I told you it was dumb. These men, going by with drunken faces and brains full of unawakened power, do not ask it of society or of God. Their lives ask it, their deaths ask it. There is no reply. I will tell you plainly that I have a great hope, and I bring it to you to be tested. It is this, that this terrible dumb question is its own reply, that it is not the sentence of death we think it, but, from the very extremity of its darkness, the most solemn prophecy which the world has known of the hope to come. I dare make my meaning no clearer, but will only tell my story. It will, perhaps, seem to you as foul and dark as this thick vapor about us, and as pregnant with death, but if your eyes are free as mine are to look deeper, no perfume-tinted dawn will be so fair with promise of the day that shall surely come. My story is very simple, only what I remember of the life of one of these men, A furnace tender in one of Kirby and John's rolling mills, Hugh Wolf. You know the mills? They took the great order for the Lower Virginia Railroads there last winter, run usually with about 1,000 men. I cannot tell why I choose the half-forgotten story of this wolf more than that of myriads of these furnace hands. Perhaps because there is a secret, underlying sympathy between that story and this day with its impure fog and thwarted sunshine, or perhaps simply for the reason that this house is the one where the wolves lived. There were the father and son, both hands, as I said, in one of Kirby and John's mills for making railroad iron, and Deborah, their cousin, a picker in some of the cotton mills. The house was rented then to half a dozen families. The wolves had two of the cellar rooms. The old man, like many of the puddlers and feeders of the mills, was Welsh, had spent half of his life in the Cornish tin mines. You may pick the Welsh emigrants, Cornish miners, out of the throng passing the windows, any day. They are a trifle more filthy, their muscles are not so brawny, they stoop more. When they are drunk, they neither yell, nor shout, nor stagger, but skulk along like beaten hounds. A pure, unmixed blood, I fancy, shows itself in the slight angular bodies and sharply cut facial lines. It is nearly 30 years since the wolves lived here. Their lives were like those of their class, incessant labor, sleeping in kennel-like rooms, eating rank pork and molasses, drinking God and the distillers only know what, with an occasional night in jail, to atone for some drunken excess. Is that all of their lives? Of the portion given to them and these their duplicates swarming the streets today? Nothing beneath? All? So many a political reformer will tell you, and many a private reformer, too, who has gone among them with a heart tender with Christ's charity, and come out outraged, heartened. One rainy night, about 11 o'clock, a crowd of half-clothed women stopped outside of the cellar door. They were going home from the cotton mill. "Good night, Deb," said one, a mulatto, steadying herself against the gas post. She needed the post to steady her. So did more than one of them. "Da's a ball to Miss Spots tonight. Ye'd best come." "Inteet, Deb, if her'll come, her'll have fun," said a shrill Welsh voice in the crowd. Two or three dirty hands were thrust out to catch the gown of the woman, who was groping for the latch of the door. "No. No? Where's Kit Small, then?" "Begorra. On the spools. Alley's behind, though we helped her, we did. Unwid ye. Let Deb alone. It's on day St. Fred in a quiet body. Be the powers, and we'll have a night of it. There'll be lashins a drink, the Vargent be blessed and praised for't." They went on, the mulatto inclining for a moment to show fight, and dragged the woman wolf off with them, but, being pacified, she staggered away. Deborah groped her way into the cellar, and, after considerable stumbling, kindled a match, and lighted a tallow dip, that sent a yellow glimmer over the room. It was low, damp, the earthen floor covered with a green, slimy moss, a fetid air smothering the breath. Old Wolf lay asleep on a heap of straw, wrapped in a torn horse blanket. He was a pale, meek little man, with a white face and red rabbit eyes. The woman Deborah was like him, only her face was even more ghastly, her lips bluer, her eyes more watery. She wore a faded cotton gown and a slouching bonnet. When she walked, one could see that she was deformed, almost a hunchback. She trod softly, so as not to waken him, and went through into the room beyond. There she found by the half-extinguished fire an iron saucepan filled with cold boiled potatoes, which she put upon a broken chair with a pint cup of ale. Placing the old candlestick beside this dainty repast, she untied her bonnet, which hung limp and wet over her face, and prepared to eat her supper. It was the first food that had touched her lips since morning. There was enough of it, however, there is not always. She was hungry, one could see that easily enough, and not drunk, as most of her companions would have been found at this hour. She did not drink, this woman, her face told that, too, nothing stronger than ale. Perhaps the weak, flaccid wretch had some stimulant in her pale life to keep her up, some love or hope, it might be, or urgent need. When that stimulant was gone, she would take to whiskey. Man cannot live by work alone. While she was skinning the potatoes, and munching them, a noise behind her made her stop. "Janie!" she called, lifting the candle and peering into the darkness. "Janie, are you there?" A heap of ragged coats was heaved up, and the face of a young girl emerged, staring sleepily at the woman. "Deborah," she said, at last, "I'm here the night." "Yes, child. Her's welcome," she said, quietly eating on. The girl's face was haggard and sickly, her eyes were heavy with sleep and hunger, real Malaysian eyes they were, dark, delicate blue, glooming out from black shadows with a pitiful fright. "I was alone," she said, timidly. "Where's the father?" asked Deborah, holding out a potato, which the girl greedily seized. "He's bayant, wid Haley, in the stone house. Did you ever hear the word tale from an Irish mouth? I came here. Pew told me never to stay Maloney."
"Pew?"
"Yes." A vexed frown crossed her face. The girl saw it, and added quickly, "Dash. I have not seen Hugh the day, Deb. The old man says his watch lasts till the morning." The woman sprang up, and hastily began to arrange some bread and flitch in a tin pail, and to pour her own measure of ale into a bottle. Tying on her bonnet, she blew out the candle. "Lay ye down, Janie dear," she said, gently, covering her with the old rags. "Her can eat the potatoes, if her's hungry. Where are ye going, Deb?" "The rain sharp." "To the mill, with Hugh's supper. Let him bide till th morn. Sit ye down." "No, no," sharply pushing her off. "The boy'll starve." She hurried from the cellar, while the child wearily coiled herself up for sleep. The rain was falling heavily, as the woman, pail in hand, emerged from the mouth of the alley, and turned down the narrow street, that stretched out, long and black, miles before her. Here and there a flicker of gas lighted an uncertain space of muddy footwalk and gutter. The long rows of houses, except an occasional lager beer shop, were closed. Now and then she met a band of millhands skulking to or from their work. Not many even of the inhabitants of a manufacturing town know the vast machinery of system by which the bodies of workmen are governed, that goes on unceasingly from year to year. The hands of each mill are divided into watches that relieve each other as regularly as the sentinels of an army. By night and day the work goes on, the unsleeping engines groan and shriek, the fiery pools of metal boil and surge. Only for a day in the week, in half courtesy to public censure, the fires are partially veiled, but as soon as the clock strikes midnight,